Well, a few weeks ago when we were just getting started in our series on the book of Daniel, I shared a few incorrect predictions that people had made about the future. And that included one bold statement from the head of the U.S. Patent Office, who in 1899 said, "Everything that can be invented has been invented." Now, that's my favorite prediction, but it's just the tip of the iceberg. Joseph Ives led the first expedition into the Grand Canyon and then promptly said, "That is the last trip anyone will take to this profitless locality." Irving Fisher, an economist, boldly declared that there's no need to worry. Stocks have reached a permanent high. That was just 3 days before Black Tuesday in the beginning of the Great Depression. Decca Records chose not to sign the Beatles in 1962 because, in their opinion, guitar music is on the way out. Finally, there's Major League Baseball Hall of Fame pitcher Tris Speaker, who said taking the game's best left-handed hitter and converting him to a right fielder so he can hit every day is the dumbest thing I have ever heard. Tris Speaker was talking about a man called Babe Ruth. Perhaps you've heard of him. History is full of failed attempts at predicting the future, and unfortunately, Christian history is full of the same. For some reason, people keep trying to predict the return of Jesus, even though Jesus explicitly says not to do so. Long story short, we're going to need to handle Daniel 11 with care this morning, because Daniel 11 not only takes an attempt at predicting the future, it actually says something about the return of Jesus. A bit indirectly, but nevertheless, it says it. Now, you can find Daniel chapter 11 on page 1356 in the Bibles under your seats. And I actually encourage you to follow along in Scripture today, because you're going to want to see what happens in this passage. Now, predicting the future is nothing new in the book of Daniel. It's just that the specificity of this final vision is pretty unique. This final vision in the book of Daniel actually takes up three chapters, chapter 10, 11, and 12. And it talks about, it discloses 375 years of history in rather stunning detail. Now, I'm going to disappoint you by telling you that we are not going to read all of those details this morning. It's not because all the details aren't important, it's just that many of them include a lot of minor league players, and I really want to focus on the major player in this vision, which is the God behind it. And we're going to skip some things this morning in order to have enough time to talk about the God behind this vision. That is, unless you want a two-hour sermon today, and I don't think you do. It's going to get to be like 95 or something. I don't want a two-hour sermon, and I like hearing myself speak, in case you've noticed. Anyway, we're going to skip some things to save as much time as possible to talk about the God behind this vision, specifically the promise that God offers us in the midst of this vision. That is the promise of resurrection that comes because of the work of Jesus. Now, as you can see, we're going to read a few sections, so I'll guide you through. We're going to skip a few verses along the way. We're going to actually trickle into chapter 12. We'll read the first four verses. Again, keep your Bible open, though, because I'm going to refer to a bunch of verses along the way. And I'll just go ahead and tell you, if you're disappointed that we're not reading all of this, or if you have questions about the things that we do read or don't read, come see me afterwards. We'll talk about this. But right now, I invite you to join me as we read this vision together, beginning Daniel chapter 11, verse 2. "Now then, I tell you the truth. Three more kings will arise in Persia, and then a fourth, who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king will arise, who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has arisen, his empire will be broken up and parceled out to the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. The king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger than he, and will rule his own kingdom with great power. After some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north and make an alliance, but she will not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. In those days she will be betrayed, together with her royal escort and her father and the one who supported her. One from her family line will arise to take her place. He will attack the forces of the king of the north and enter his fortress. He will fight against them and be victorious. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, and their valuable articles of silver and gold and carry them off to Egypt. For some years, he will leave them, leave the king of the north alone. Then the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south, but will retreat to his own country. His sons will prepare for war and assemble a great army, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south will march out in a rage and fight against the king of the north, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated. When the army is carried off, the king of the south will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands, yet he will not remain triumphant. For the king of the north will muster another army, larger than the first, and after several years he will advance with a huge army fully equipped. In those times, many will rise against the king of the south. Those who are violent among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. Then the king of the north will come and build up siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. The forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand. The invader will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land and will have the power to destroy it. He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south. And he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom. But his plans will not succeed or help him. Then he will turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them. But a commander will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back on him. After this, he will turn back toward the fortresses of his own country, but will stumble and fall to be seen no more. His successor will send a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Now, if you'll skip to verse 31. His army forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. With flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. When they fall, they will receive a little help. They will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. All right, we're going to skip to verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He will also invade the beautiful land. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver and all the riches of Egypt, with the Libyans and Cushites in submission. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress such as has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. But at that time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness, like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, roll up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase in knowledge. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Thanks to God giving you attention to make it through that. It's a lot of words, and again, we didn't read all of it, but like I said, it chronicles 375 years of history. Now, what I didn't tell you, though, is the history isn't exhaustive, even though it feels like it, I'm sure. This vision actually is aimed at spotlighting the suffering of God's people while they wait for God to deliver on his promises. Because that is the focus of the vision, the vision tends to skip over portions of history that are irrelevant to the subject at hand. So, this vision actually skips over at least 100-plus years of history twice. Not because nothing significant happened during those years, it's just that there was no real suffering in Israel during those years. Additionally, at the end of this vision, it skips over an undisclosed period of time to get to the end of time when God finally delivers on his promises. Of course, we're not going to get ahead of ourselves. That's how the vision ends. Let's look at how it begins. It begins in verse 2 with three kings who are widely understood to be Cambyses, Smerdis, and Darius the Great, not to be confused with Darius the Mede, who we met back in Daniel 5. Don't get lost in the names, because a fourth king pops on the scene pretty quickly, who is widely believed to be Xerxes. Xerxes is richer than the rest. He was fabulously wealthy. He was also incredibly prideful. In fact, you can read about Xerxes. He's the husband of Esther. You can read about him in the book that bears the name of Esther. In all his pride and in all his wealth, Xerxes actually launched an attack against the Greek Empire, which would start a war which would lead to the eventual downfall of the Persian Empire. Now, there aren't many details in here, and in fact, this is the first place where we skip over some history. In fact, we skip over 130 years and 8 additional Persian kings. There aren't many details, but it says this in verse 3. Then a king, a mighty king, will arise who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has arisen, his empire will be broken up and parceled out to the four winds of heaven. Now, despite the fact that volumes have been written about him, Daniel gives one verse to a man named Alexander the Great. Perhaps you've heard of him. Now, no one would say that Alexander the Great is insignificant. It's just that he and the other 8 Persian kings before him are irrelevant to the subject at hand. That is, they did not do much to cause suffering for the people of Israel. Alexander is pretty much passed over because Alexander pretty much just passed through Israel on his way to conquering other nations. There was little suffering in Israel. The suffering would actually come at the hands of those who would follow Alexander. Alexander died prematurely. His kingdom did not get passed to his children. It was divided up between 4 of his generals, and those 4 generals could not stop fighting. 2 of those generals in particular could not stop fighting in the middle of Israel. That's because the border of their territories ran right through the middle of Israel. It's kind of like the demilitarized zone on the Korean Peninsula, except there was some actual militarization here. These generals kept meeting in Israel, kept fighting, and God's people suffered as a result. The thing is, that is nothing compared to what's about to happen. Verses 5 through 20, 16 entire verses, are dedicated to chronicling the next 160 years. Why such detail? Well, because there was unbelievable suffering at the hands of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Now, this is that part where you may have lost me when I was reading it. It's actually a really, really interesting section, but it is really, really confusing. That's because the vision keeps jumping from one king of the south to the next king of the south to the next, and from one king of the north to the next king of the north. And here's the thing. Both of these empires were remarkably uncreative with names. It's like George Foreman. You remember this guy? He was a heavyweight boxer. Then he started making these grills. George Foreman named all of his children George. All of them, George. Well, in the same way that George Foreman did that, every king of Egypt, that is, king of the south, was named Ptolemy, and every Syrian king of the north was either named Seleucus or Antiochus. Now, it takes some work to see this, but Daniel 11 actually predicts the history of all these kings in really stunning detail. So much so that people say this had to have been written after the fact. It's just too accurate. I don't think we have to jump to that conclusion. And I also don't think we have to spend so much time trying to flesh it out right now, because all the details about all these battles between the kings and the north and the south really sets the stage for what God is about to do next. Verse 18 says, a commander will put an end to the king of the north. That's a simple reference, but it's a reference to the Roman defeat of Antiochus the Great. Rome killed this king of the north, and then they took his son hostage. That son would grow up in captivity where he would learn to despise the Roman Empire. And when he grew up, he would spend his entire life trying to defeat the Roman Empire. Do you know what that son's name was? Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, we talked a lot about Antiochus Epiphanes way back in Daniel chapter 8, and so we're not going to spend time on him today. If you want to know more about this man, you can find the sermon that I preached on Daniel 8 on our website. Today, I will simply say this, that if you'll look at verse 21, you will see that he is referred to as a contemptible person. Antiochus is not referred to as a king because he is not the rightful heir of the Seleucid Empire. Antiochus murdered his way into power, and he followed the same tactics to stay in power. He murdered anyone that he thought was a threat, including lots of members of his own family. Now, Jews were no threat to Antiochus's throne, but it didn't matter. Jews suffered tremendously under this man. In fact, verses 21 to 39, which we didn't read, detail, perhaps a little too much, exactly how much they suffered. But then something happens in verse 40. Everything stops making sense, at least when it comes to Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, the good news is everyone agrees about this. Everyone says something happens between verses 39 and 40. There's a change. The bad news is, no one agrees on what the change is. Now, in the same way that when we looked at Daniel 9 a few weeks ago, and we talked about the fact that there are multiple ways to interpret this, there are multiple ways to interpret Daniel 11. By the way, if you want to find out what we talked about with Daniel 9, I encourage you to check it out. It's helpful for understanding this vision. You can find that on our website. Right now, take a deep breath, because we are going to quickly look at three ways to interpret Daniel 11. The first is the already happened view. This view says there's a change in verse 40 because the book of Daniel was written right after Antiochus Epiphanes died. It was written somewhere around 167 BC. And the reason verses 2 through 39 make sense is because this is all history that had happened. It's accurate because someone's just recording the events. But things change in verse 40 and following because there is where the author starts trying to predict the future. And you know how that typically goes, right? That's the already happened view. The second view is the not yet view. This view says that verses 2 through 39 accurately predicts the Ptolemies, the Seleucids, and Antiochus Epiphanes. But verse 40 jumps all the way ahead to the end of time, where it refers not to Antiochus Epiphanes, but to the Antichrist, who opposes God and God's people in ways that Antiochus only foreshadowed. Now, both of these views, I'll tell you, they are both plausible, but there are significant problems with both views. If you want to talk about those problems, come see me later. Right now, I'm going to point you to a third view, and that is the already happened, not yet view. The already happened, not yet view is the view that I think is best because it aligns with things that we have already talked about in Daniel, specifically Daniel 7, 8, and 9. Those visions make sense with this vision if you follow this view. The already happened, not yet view says that in verse 40, when it says the time of the end, it isn't talking about the end of the world, it's talking about the end of the Greek Empire. This view says that verses 2 through 39 are all about the Greek Empire. But a change happens in verse 40. Suddenly, it is the Roman Empire that becomes it's in the spotlight. Now, this view requires a 100-year gap between verses 39 and verse 40, but that shouldn't be a problem, A, because we've already jumped ahead 130 years once in this vision, and secondly, do you remember what we said about this at the start of this? God skips over history that is irrelevant to the subject at hand. Well, guess what? There was relatively little suffering in Israel after Antiochus Epiphanes died. It was a time of peace, relatively speaking. That is until about 100 years later, when a new king of the north, a Roman king, took over, suffering ramps up again. This Roman king, this new king of the north, is a man named Pompey. And if your Bible's still open, you can watch how this imagery works. Pompey took control of Syria in 62 BC, which made him the king of the north. Pompey then went to war with the king of the south, which required him to march south through the beautiful land, that is, through Israel, where he had some skirmishes with Edom and Moab, as verse 41 says. Then, as verse 43 says, he marched into Egypt, where he took Egypt and Libya and Cush. Until, as verse 44 says, rumors about trouble in the north and east stopped him in his tracks. Pompey was primed and ready to take control of Africa, but reports about someone leading a rebellion back in Israel caught his ears. The someone he heard about was a man named Julius Caesar. Perhaps you've heard of him. And the agreement he heard about was a treaty between Julius Caesar and a man named Herod. Herod was the puppet king of Israel at the time. And he's called Herod the Great in history, but he was not great. In fact, his allegiance was always for sale. What happened for Pompey is he was ready to take control of Africa, and he heard that Julius Caesar had bought Herod the Great. And so he stormed back to Israel in a great rage to fight Caesar. The people of Israel got caught up in the crosshairs. They suffered because these two Roman generals were fighting until they made peace. Pompey and Caesar eventually made a treaty. They formed an alliance. They actually formed something called a triumvirate with a man named Crassus. Is this sounding familiar, like history class that maybe you thought you'd forgot or maybe you wanted to forget? They formed peace, but it was a short-lived peace because, as verse 45 says, Pompey came to his end. Pompey was assassinated in 48 BC, and a new line of kings of the north known as the Caesars took over. This sets the stage for God to act. Now, the details are a bit tedious, but this is why I think the already happened, not yet view is best. Remember, that's what we're talking about. It was during the Roman Empire. Under the rule of the Caesars, under the thumb of a Jewish tetrarch named Herod the Great, that Jesus was born. It was under all those conditions that God acted on our behalf. Not in acting like the kings in this vision. God didn't come to go to war with his enemies. God came to die for his enemies and then to rise again in victory. Now, if you're wondering how I'm getting that out of Daniel 11, here's the thing. I'm not getting that out of Daniel 11. I'm getting that out of Daniel 12. Daniel 12 says, there will be a time of distress such as has not happened from the beginning of the nations until then. That's not exactly a high note, but this was reality for the people of Israel under Roman rule. According to the Jewish historian Josephus, millions of Jews died between Pompey's rise in 62 BC and Jerusalem's fall in 70 AD. It's a time of great suffering. And yet something happened in the middle of all this that changes everything. Somewhere around 30 AD, Jesus was crucified. 3 days later, he rose from the grave. And in light of that, God says this in verses 1 and 2. Your people, everyone whose name is written in the book, will be delivered. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake. Some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. And once again, this vision skips over some history, a whole lot of history to be exact. I mean, this skips to the end of time, which is a huge jump, but this is actually consistent with what we've seen in this vision thus far. God skips over history that isn't relevant to the subject at hand. Well, guess what? The subject at hand changes with the coming of Jesus. That is, the suffering of God's people is no longer in focus. The suffering of God is now in focus. Not because our suffering is irrelevant, but because it isn't ultimate. There are two ways to look at human history, writes Philip Yancey. One is to focus on the wars and violence, the squalor, the pain and tragedy and death. From that point of view, Easter, that is Jesus' resurrection, seems a fairy tale exception, a stunning contradiction in the name of God. That gives some solace, although I confess that when my friends die, the grief is so overpowering that hope in an afterlife seems somehow thin and insubstantial. But there's another way to look at the world. If I take Easter as the starting point, the one undeniable fact about how God treats those whom he loves, then human history becomes the contradiction, and Easter a preview of ultimate reality. Hope flows like lava beneath the crust of daily life. This perhaps describes the change in Jesus' disciples as they sat in locked rooms discussing the incomprehensible events of Easter Sunday. In one sense, nothing had changed. Rome still occupied Palestine. Religious authorities still had a bounty on their heads. Death and evil still reigned outside. And yet, gradually, the shock of recognition gave way to a long, slow undertow of joy. The wise are those who believe that. That's what chapter 12, verse 3 basically says. The wise aren't those who are clever enough to figure out the details of this prophecy. The wise are those who learn to trust the God behind this prophecy. The wise are those who begin to see life not through the lens of our suffering, but through the lens of Jesus' resurrection. The wise are those who, by God's grace, begin to live in light of God's love. Those who begin to feel the pull of this long, slow undertow of joy. Those who begin to shine with the brightness of heaven, and thereby those who lead others to righteousness. Here's a question. Probably know it's coming. Are you wise? Do you believe this? There is little that is certain in this world, but there are two things that are absolutely certain. One, we will all die. And two, according to God, we will all be resurrected. Some will be raised to life in Jesus, where we will receive everything that God made us for in the beginning and everything that God will restore the world to in the end. Others will rise to shame and contempt. That is, to receive more of the same from this life. Not the good stuff of this life, the broken things, the emptiness, the loneliness, the loss that we experience when we live life outside of fellowship with the God who made us. Again, are you wise? Do you believe the good news? God invites us to believe it. For the first time or once again, and to thereby live in light of his love both now and evermore. This is the invitation, friends. Be wise. Believe the good news. And shine like the stars of heaven.